The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Josephus Flavius, Traitor or Hero, is the 12th of a 16-part series from Yavne to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Ne'ilui Nishmas Feivel Ben Pesach Olav HaSholem, Mr. Frank Witzel of Blessed Memory.
One of the most problematic figures of antiquity is the historian, scholar, polemicist, and military leader, Yosef ben Matisyahu, or as he's more commonly known, Josephus Flavius. Undoubtedly, the world's most quoted and influential Jewish historian, Josephus left us a rich legacy of records and insight into early Jewish history, especially the events that shaped the final years of the temple and its immediate aftermath. It would be impossible to reconstruct much of the details of that era without his contribution. In a certain sense, we all owe him a great debt of gratitude. He was also one of the world's most eloquent defenders of Jews and Judaism. His work against Apion is a classic in polemic literature, exquisitely destroying the arguments of the anti-Semites of his day and offering a breathtaking view of the beauty of the community and spirit of Jewry at the time of the destruction of the temple. On the other hand, though, he's caused us tremendous harm. His own bias, as well as the influence of the Roman emperors Vespasian and Titus, his personal benefactors, has colored much of his narrative and has had a negative effect on the way the Christian and his secular historians have viewed Jews and Judaism to this very day. His personality, both its strengths and flaws, is so much part of his work that it's almost impossible to understand and appreciate the history that Josephus wrote without understanding Josephus himself. What kind of a man was Josephus? From the sources that we're going to share together tonight, we see a very complicated man full of contradictions. A self-acclaimed Pharisee, Josephus's description of the Pharisees are so full of hate and resentment that they closely resemble the statements of the early church and the Essenes towards the rabbinic establishment. In fact, Josephus's true love and admiration seems to lie with the Essenes, from whom he has nothing but praise. A man who described himself as a leading scholar, his works are full of serious errors and unforgivable flaws. A self-styled brilliant leader of the revolt against the Romans in the Galilee, Josephus, by his own admission, failed miserably to mount a credible opposition to the Roman legions. His troops scattered and fled at the first opportunity. Not only was he defeated by the enemy, but he eventually went over to their side and became their spokesman. In short, he was a complex figure whose own worldview and character flaws were enmeshed with the history that he wrote. Understanding Josephus is therefore essential to understanding one of the most crucial periods of our history. But perhaps the best spokesman, the one who is most qualified to speak about Josephus, is Josephus himself. And I hope all of you have the handout. On the first page, we're going to read some of the quotes from his autobiography. This was written towards the end of his life. It was in his mid-60s. There he wrote this work to defend his conduct of the war. There was another historical work that came out from one of his enemies, Justus of Tiberius. And here he defends himself and his conduct. Here on the first paragraph, paragraph A, in the middle of that paragraph. Now, I am not only sprung from a sacerdotal family in general, it was from the priestly family, he was a Kohen, but from the first of the 24 courses. The Kohanim were divided into 24 groups, Mishmoros, and each group worked on their week. So in a period of 24 weeks, all the Kohanim, it was in Israel, had a chance to work in the temple. And again, it went. It's Choser Chalila. And again, it started again. The in Divrei Hayomim, in the first book of Chronicles, describes how these 24 clans or 24 groups were chosen. And they were chosen through a lot. In other words, they wrote their names. Anyone who's bought, the lotto knows what happens here. Everyone had their names, and someone stuck in their hands. In the first week, one name came out. For the second group, another name came out. In the first temple, the clan that worked the first week of that cycle, the 24-week cycle, was Yehoyoriv. The second week was Yedaya. That was the name of the family. Probably it came from the founder of the family. In the second temple, in the beginning of the second temple, most of the surviving priests remained in Babylon, remained in exile. And only four families came up. So again, from these four families, there had to be a division into 24 groups. As every family was divided into six groups. And the first group of this new, in other words, now they have to get a new lottery, and a new division, Yedaya, which originally was the second group in the first temple, became the first group in the second temple. In other words, when you had the 24 weeks, so Yedaya worked the first week. And it would seem that he worked the five subsequent weeks as well. And then came another family. So instead of actually having 24 distinct families, we had these four families redivided. So now again we had 24 families. So he is from the first of the 24 courses. It would seem that he is from the family of Yedaya. And as among us there is not only a considerable difference between one family of each course and another, evidently he maintained, and probably this was a view that was prevalent amongst the Kohanim, that the ones who come first, evidently, are better, even though it was only chosen by lot. You see what kovod is, even then. I am of the chief family of that chief course also. Each of these 24 courses, in other words, these 24 groups, were again divided into what was called a base of. In other words, the group is called a mishmor, the subgrouping is called a base of. And through the days of the week, each one of these subgroupings worked. In other words, on Sunday, it was one group, on Monday, another group throughout the whole week. Actually, there seems to be a difference of opinion between the major commentaries, between Rashi and the Rambam, if there were six groupings or seven. In other words, seven would mean, again, each of these separate subgroupings worked a separate day of the week, and a separate group worked on Shabbos. Or there were only six groupings, those six worked the 6 days of the week, and on Shabbos they all came together. But he maintained he is of the chief family of the chief course, which would seem to indicate that they worked on Sundays. Nay, farther, so that's first his yichus from his family, from his father's side. But by my mother, I am of the royal blood. For the children of Asmoneus, this Hashmonoi, he is descendant from the Maccabees, from whom that family was derived, had both the office of the high priesthood and the dignity of a king for a long time together. He claimed, and he writes in his genealogy, that he is descendant from a daughter of Yonason. In other words, Yonason, there were five original Maccabee brothers. Those of you heard of Yehuda Maccabee. After Yehuda Maccabee was killed in battle, his brother Yonason took over. Yonason was killed, and afterwards Shimon was the one who took over. So he claimed to be a descendant of this Yonason, the second ruling brother. He goes on, after he describes the family in general, he goes on to his immediate family. And we have paragraph B. Now my father, Matthias, was not only eminent on account of his nobility, but had a higher commendation on account of his righteousness, was in great reputation in Jerusalem, the greatest city we have. I was myself brought up with my brother, whose name was Matthias. As it seems, the son had the same name of the father, which we will discuss soon. For he was my own brother by both father and mother. And I made mighty proficiency in the improvements of my learning and appeared to have both a great memory and understanding. Moreover, when I was a child, about 14 years of age, I was commended by all for the love I had to learning, on which account the high priests and principal men of the city came then frequently to me together in order to know my opinion about the accurate understandings of points of the law. Whatever you're going to say about Josephus, one thing, he doesn't suffer from the modern malady of a low self-esteem. One wonders, though, when he was born in the year 37, as he traces, he was born in the year that Gaius Caligula became the emperor, which in our estimation is the year 37. When he was 14, that comes the year 51. In the year 51, Yochanan ben Zakkai was the Rosh Yeshiva. He had Talmidim Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. He may be good, Josephus, but ones we're going to see from his halachas, he wasn't all that great. One wonders, who were the principal men and the high priests that came to seek his opinion? A clue was was by the fact that his father named his son by his own name. Generally, Jews don't. The common practice is we don't have many juniors. The cases that are mentioned generally are situations where the father died while the mother was still pregnant, and therefore they gave the name of the child after the deceased father. It's rare. But in cases of a living father, it's something that was common amongst the Herodians. Herod named several of his kids Herod. Agrippas, who was a grandson of Herod, had a son, Agrippas. One of the leaders in the Galilee was a person by the name of Comsus, the son of Comsus. Rabbi Victor Miller, one of his works, suggests that this Comsus, the son of Comsus, just mentioned in passing in Josephus, was actually Kamsa Bar Kamsa. There's a very famous story about the destruction of the Second Temple, that there was a person who had a friend, Kamsa. He had an enemy, Bar Kamsa, the son of Kamsa. There was a confusion about the invitations, and Bar Kamsa came instead of Kamsa. He suggests that the Bar Kamsa that came was really this figure, Kamsas, the son of Kamsas. In other words, and it was an honest mistake, because both had the first name Kamsa. The question was, the other one had, was called Bar Kamsa, and it was because he was Kamsa Jr. But the person mentioned, in any case, by Josephus, this Kamsas Bar Kamsas, was again, it seems to be, someone who had great affinity to the Herodians. And it would seem the fact that his father gave a child a name after him seems to show that his the father's leanings were with the Sadducees, those who were close to the Herodians, rather than the Pharisees. It would make sense in that case. The high priests, by the way, with only one exception that we know of, but very rare exception, the high priests were very corrupt, were appointed by the Herodian kings, and were, it seems to be, Sadducees. The principal men, means the men of power then, would be Sadducees. And amongst them, if they had questions of law, they probably would feel more comfortable with this 14-year-old, this brilliant 14-year-old, the son of their friend, rather than going to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai or Shimon ben Gamliel, one of the other leading Pharisees, their opponents. But whatever, however we understand his father's position, it seems that this Josephus was a very mixed-up young man, which leads us to the third paragraph here, paragraph C. When I was 16 years old, I had a mind to make a trial of the several sects that were among us. These sects are three. The first is that of the Pharisees. The second, that of the Sadducees. And the third, that of the Essenes, as we have frequently told you. The Pharisees are the, we call the ancestors of what we call rabbinic Judaism. In other words, how Judaism has been practiced for at least 2,000 years, if not 3,000 years. The Sadducees were those who denied the idea of rabbinic authority both in interpretation and in legislation. But perhaps even more important, they denied the idea of an afterlife and also the idea that God really cares about the affairs of mankind, as they were very secularized Jews. The Essenes, which was the subject of the last lecture, were a very extreme sect that really rejected normative life, were by and large celibate, lived in their own communities, and were not part of the mainstream. As Josephus writes time and time again, and we will hopefully touch upon this later, the Pharisees, which were the rabbis, were the leaders of almost all of Jewry, except for the small pocket of Sadducees and Essenes. So here we deal with Pharisees, we're really dealing with the rabbinic establishment. And he was not sure which one to choose. These are big choices here. It isn't like when my children have a question, well, which yeshiva should they go to? Should they go to Telz, Shiva Gadol? These are small choices. The choice of being a Pharisee or a Sadducee or an Essene is a very big choice. And at 16, a child who's not sure yet evidently is a He's a very mixed up little boy. For I thought that by this means I might choose the best if I were once acquainted with them all. And he goes on to say that he tried all three. And not only did he expose himself to these three major sects, but when I was informed that one whose name was Banus lived in the desert and used no other clothing than grew upon trees and had no other food than what grew of its own accord, and bathed himself in cold water frequently, both by night and by day, in order to preserve his chastity, I imitated him in those things and continued with him for 3 years. And there's a question amongst the scholars, is the 3 years the total period? In other words, including the trial of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the Essenes, or he gave a full 3 years together with this Banus. So when I accomplished my desires, I returned back to the city, being now 19 years old, and began to conduct myself according to the rules of the sect of the Pharisees, which is of kin to the sect of the Stoics, as the Greeks call them. How much a Pharisee was Josephus, we are going to see soon. The choice does not necessarily mean it was a choice of theology, but rather it was a social choice. You basically had to belong somewhere. He opted not to join Banus in the desert, and he decided to remain in the city. He had to be part of somebody, and his choice then was to be part of the Pharisees, but not necessarily because actually he believed in it, but he felt most comfortable being part of that society. There's a gap in his life, and he takes us now to the 26th year of his life. It was on page 2, where after friends of his, Kohanim, priests, were imprisoned by the Roman governor of Judea and were sent to Rome to defend, to plead their cause, Josephus decided to leave Palestine, to leave Israel, and to go by ship to defend, to somehow influence the events and defend his friends. He describes a shipwreck, and finally he arrived in Italy. And at the bottom of paragraph D, we find, I became acquainted with, says, Aluturius, an actor of plays and much beloved by Nero, but a Jew by birth. One wonders what kind of a person this Aluturius was. We know from Dio Cassius, from Tacitus, from the Roman historians, what kind of a person Nero was. He, it would seem from all accounts, he was not one of those Lamed Vov Tzadikim. The Aluturius, who was much beloved, one wonders what kind of a person he was as well. And through his interests became known to Poppaea, Caesar's wife. Caesar's wife, Josephus describes in another place, seems that she was a monotheist. Now, she had very positive feelings towards Judaism, and took care as soon as possible to entreat her to procedure that the priests might be set at liberty. So through this Aluturius, he became known to Poppaea, and when, besides this favor, I had obtained many presents from Poppaea, I returned home again. And here we see a totally different facet in Josephus' life. Even though he complains in other sections that he never totally mastered the Greek language, and even to this day, that he wrote later in his life, he speaks it with an accent because he was raised evidently in Aramaic, in Hebrew Aramaic. But he seems to have done pretty good for Agrina, you know, he did pretty good for himself. And here we have a peek of his diplomatic skills, which we're only going to touch upon. but which put him in good standing through his through the period where he was a governor or general in the Galilee. When he came back, it seems that trip to Rome had made it a lasting impression on Josephus. In the interim, when he was gone, much had happened in Palestine. It seems that by and large, the Roman governors, the procurators, were corrupt. And they were aided and abetted by the Sadducee high priests, who, appointed by the Herodians, and we're going to explain that in a second, wielded an awful amount of power. To the extent, in fact, and they were so corrupt, that they had the whole market of the priestly entitlements, the trumas meisen, is that those gifts that are given to the Kohanim, to the priests, the high priests, and those the former high priests, because they kept on changing office. It wasn't as it normally should have been, that a person was a high priest for life, and at an old age when he died, he was taken over by someone else, preferably his son. But rather, since the office was bought of high priest, because it wasn't controlled, the office itself was not controlled by the Sanhedrin, but it was controlled by a descendant of Herod. See, when Herod took over, he had total control, and he appointed high priests and fired them at will. When Herod died, and afterwards his Archelaus, his son who took over for Judea, was exiled, the Romans took over. Finally, the Romans gave over the power of appointing high priests back to a grandson of Herod's. So that who was to be the high priest was decided by Herod's grandson. The Herodians, except with the exception of Agrippas the First, who reigned for just a short period of time, were basically assimilated. And the people they chose were by and large not Pharisees, were not part of the rabbinic establishment, but were Sadducees. And through their influence, that being the high priest and having this office that was appointed through the Herodians, just as a side point, just to give you a further understanding of the dynamics here, Herod was the king over all of what is today Israel, including parts of what is today Jordan. When he died, his kingdom was divided amongst his sons. Later, when Archelaus was exiled, his son, Judea was not given over to the Herodians, but was empowered by the Roman governor. That was the governor of that area, really had the political control. So it wasn't a king who was a puppet king, but rather this was a Roman governor. Eventually, a grandson of Herod, by the name of Agrippas, was appointed king over the former dominions of his grandfather. His kingship over all of Israel only lasted some 3 years. And when he died, Judea, the area around Jerusalem, was again given over to the Romans. The northern parts of what was his kingdom were given over to his relatives, and eventually to his son, whose name was also Agrippas. This son, Agrippas, never became king over Jerusalem, over Judea, from the time that his father Agrippa died in the year 44 until the destruction of the temple. There was no Herodian or Jewish king over Jerusalem or over Judea. Agrippas, his son, Agrippas II, was a king over the northern part of Israel. Those are the Galilee, a part of the area which is on the other side of the Jordan, but never Jerusalem. But though he did not have political power over Jerusalem or over Judea, the Romans granted him the power of appointing high priests, and also he had the power over the temple treasury. This Agrippas. So even though he was not king over the area, he exerted powerful control. And there was tremendous resentment by the corruption of these high priests. And when one high priest who bought his office from Agrippas was fired from office because another high priest gave Agrippas more money to appoint the next one, there was open fighting in the streets. And Josephus describes these gangs of the former high priests had their thugs. It was open war of the mafiosos. It was like St. Valentine's Day. And as you go through the streets, and they'd be throwing rocks at each other. It was totally corrupt. And these are the Kohanim, Gedolim. These are the high priests. There was a tremendous disgust amongst the common folk of what was happening with the Herodian influence and this Agrippas, with the Sadducees and the high priests. And these were the people that clamored for independence. As we're going to see, the rabbinic establishment was caught in a bind. On one hand, they realized they could never conquer Rome. On the other hand, they knew that there had to be a change in the status quo, that this corruption had to end. The last of the Roman procurators, last of the Roman governors in Judea, was a person by the name of Gessius Florus. And he, as Josephus describes, was the most corrupt of them all. And that the climax of all this corruption was an incident that Florus came to the temple with a whole troop of men and demanded money from the temple treasury. And there was an outburst of opposition, and his men were repulsed, and he was forced to flee Jerusalem. And the people that repulsed him, the most radical elements, started taking control of Jerusalem against the will of the Sadducee high priests. When Josephus had come back from Rome, in this whole trip, he was greeted with this in this situation of political ferment. He had seen Rome and all its might, and told them they're crazy for even trying to entertain thoughts of being able to push away the Romans. But as he writes here, this is in the bottom page too, I foresaw that the end of such war would be most unfortunate for us. But I could not persuade them, for the madness of desperate men was quite too hard for me. And when things got very hot, this is on page 3, in paragraph B, and this was after the Florus had been repulsed, and Florus left a contingent, a garrison of soldiers in a fortress which was right north of the temple. Those were connected almost to the temple. Was a fortress which is called Antonio. In other words, that Herod had named in honor of Mark Antony, had named this fortress Antonio. Eventually, the zealots, in other words, those who were responsible for the revolution, attacked Antonio and displaced the garrison. Eventually, they killed all the Romans that would have been placed in Jerusalem. There was an internal fight amongst them. And this says, as I retired, this is on page 3, paragraph B, as I retired into the inner court of the temple, which he was in, he felt that he would be outside of all the political turmoil. Yet did I go out of the temple again after Menachem and the principal of the band of robbers were put to death. These were the most radical group amongst these zealots who killed the Roman garrison and who has, at least this is how Josephus describes, wanted to become the leadership in Jerusalem. They were confronted by another group and they were put to death. He was in the temple court when I bode among the high priests and the chief of the Pharisees. He does not name him. But no small fear seized upon us when we saw the people in arms, while we ourselves knew not that what we should do, and were not able to restrain the seditious. However, as the danger was directly upon us, because they were, at least Josephus was, and the high priests, because they owed their whole office to the whole establishment, they were appointed by Agrippus, this Herodian, who was given power of appointment by the Romans. They were aided and abetted by the Roman procurators, the governors, that they worked hand in hand for their corruption. The high priests were in favor of maintaining the status quo. The zealots who led this revolt really looked upon these high priests as much cause of their problems as the Romans themselves. So as the danger was directly upon us, we pretended that we were of the same opinion with them, but only advised them to be quiet for the present and to let the enemy go away. In other words, they told them not to be too radical. In other words, they tried to preach moderation, but at the same time, they were just biding, stalling for time. Because we're really with you guys, you know, we're really on your side. But he finishes still hoping that Gessius Florus, because this was the former, would not long ere he came, because he would come soon, and with great forces, and so put an end to these seditious proceedings. Here we see clearly that Josephus's leanings were towards the status quo and the Romans. And the whole face he put forward as a sympathizer with the revolution was really just to save time, because he knew it was futile. And it would seem that from indications before, and as we'll see indications further on, that his real sentiments were really with the establishment, with the Sadducees. So the story that we have from his biography, and let's just recap what we have about this man. He comes from a very prestigious family. He is close to the high priests. At 16, evidently because there were so many different groupings amongst Jews, he wanted to make some sort of a decision, where should he belong? After 3 years, he decided to belong with the Pharisees. But it seems, as what we've read and what we will read, he was not a true Pharisee. Notice he wasn't one of the rabbis themselves. he practiced it because that's where he felt most comfortable to belong. But he had tremendous respect for Rome and Roman power. He had respect for the high priests. And he really wanted the Romans to destroy those people in revolt. And as he wanted Gessius Florus to come, he wanted to kill all these people, and he wanted things to be back to where they were. And he only pretended to sympathize with the cause of the revolution. This is what we have so far. The picture that comes out from this is the picture we have from his autobiography so far. The picture that that emerges from his Roman wars is not entirely different, but here we have him as a whole revolutionary. And we're just going to read some of this. This material was handed out for you. Hopefully that in your spare time afterwards you'll go through this at length. We're just going to be touching on some of these points. He describes that after Gessius Florus did attempt to come back, Florus came back with the governor of Syria and with one a whole Roman legion to try to suppress the revolt. They were repulsed. In fact, almost that whole legion was annihilated. And the revolutionaries were feeling their oats, so to speak. And they felt themselves invincible. But they knew that the Romans would come back. So they divided all of Israel into different sections and appointed generals over different sections to lead the revolt. Josephus was appointed in a meeting that was held in the temple. It seems the temple, probably in the Harabias, on the Temple Mount. Josephus was appointed to be the military governor of the Galilee. And that's the area around the Kinneret, Lake Tiberias. And he describes how he acted as general. On page 3 here, on paragraph A, this is the middle of the paragraph about after he was appointed to be the military governor's first care was to gain the goodwill of the people of that country, as sensible that he should thereby have general good success, although he should fail in other points, as we're going to see. And being conscious to himself that if he communicated part of his power to the great men, he should make them his fast friends, as he'll share his power, so therefore he will not just act on his own, but will act in concert with men of influence, and they will therefore psychologically feel that they are one. And he should gain the same favor from the multitude if he executed his commands by persons of their own country, because he was not from the Galilee. He was just sent. Right? He was from Jerusalem. And with whom they were well acquainted, he chose out 70 of the most prudent men, and those elders in age, and appointed them to be rulers of all Galilee. So first he appointed 70 rulers. This is his story here. As he chose 7 judges in the city to hear the lesser quarrels, and he chose a whole court system. The greater causes and those who were in life and death were concerned, he enjoined they should be brought to him and the 70 elders. Josephus also, when he settled these rules for determining causes by the law with regard to the people's dealings done with another, he betook himself to make provisions for their safety against external violence. And as he knew the Romans would fall upon Galilee, he built walls in proper places. And he goes on to describe all the areas where he built the walls. And on page 4, it continues, he also got together an army out of Galilee of more than 100,000 young men, all of whom he armed with the old weapons which he had collected together, prepared for them. That's a big army. Vespasian only brought, in the height of the war, 60,000 soldiers. And when he had considered that the Roman power became invincible chiefly by their readiness in obeying orders and the constant exercise of their arms, he despaired teaching his men the use of their arms, which would be obtained by experience. Which is a little funny here. I mean, if you don't use your arms, if you don't use weapons, you're not a very, you know, there's not much of a soldier to. But observing that their readiness in obeying orders was owing to the multitude of their officers, the Romans were successful. He made his partitions in his army more after the Roman manner and appointed a great many subalterns. This is minor officers, tribunes. He also distributed the soldiers into various classes. He put under captains of tens, captains of hundreds, and them under captains of thousands. And besides these, he had commanders of larger bodies of men. It's General Patton himself here. He also taught them to give the signals one to another and to call and recall soldiers by the trumpets, how to expand the wings of an army, to make them wheel about. When one wing hath had success, to turn again, assist those who are hard to get, and join in the defense of what had most suffered. He goes on to say that of the 100,000 men that he put in uniform, not all of them were actually fighters. When he put the greatest trust, there about says that he really had 6,000 footmen, and this reads 250 horsemen, which seems the commentators, Josephus, are wondering about the veracity of this number exactly. I mean, so few horsemen to footmen. Besides the on which he put the greatest trust, there were about 4,500 mercenaries. Unless he has 100,000 men in arms. But his greatest trust were in 4,500 non-Jews. These are mercenaries trained, I don't know, soldiers or hoodlums. He also 600 men as guards of his body. No. Originally 60,000 of these were of the Galileans. Evidently the rest may have been involved in logistics. And he had 600 personal guards. So here we find him as an organizer of a whole army. A military genius. Even though, as we spoke before, he really didn't have any military training. His whole experience in Rome was trying to work behind the scenes and trying to get free these priests. So the story that we have in the Roman Wars is Josephus was sent to be the military governor and he went and trained those men. At the end of his life, he wrote his autobiography to defend himself against the criticisms of another one of the principal men who lived at that time in the Galilee, in Tiberius, Justus of Tiberius. Here Josephus sings a different song. It seems from this version, written many years later, that he was not appointed to be a governor at all. Which really gives us a pause about how much can we trust Josephus at all. And here on page 5, given what these principal men of Jerusalem were, seeing that the robbers and innovators had arms in great plenty, and fearing lest they, while they were unprovided with arms, should be in subjugation to their enemies. In other words, here are the high priests who are not armed. Those who are the pro-Roman element cannot, by virtue of fighting, can't deal with the revolutionaries. And being informed that all Galilee had not yet revolted from the Romans, so they felt that they could impart their influence there, that they should not join the rebels of Jerusalem. But that some part of it was still quiet, they sent me and two other of the priests, who were men of excellent characters, Joezer and Yehuda, in order to persuade the ill men there to lay down their arms. This is a totally different story here. And to teach them this lesson, the way it's written is not very clear, but they were better to have those arms reserved for the most courageous men that the nation had. In other words, they themselves should not bear arms, but wait for an organized effort that would come from Jerusalem, if the time would come.
For that had been resolved, that our best men should always have their arms ready against futurity, but evidently telling them not to bear arms, that they should wait and to see what the Romans would do. Basically, they came on a peace mission. And he came with these two other priests. He goes on to describe, and it's a how eventually those two priests left him. And it's, again, the time doesn't allow all the material, I advise you, it's a fascinating story. And when he was alone, he goes and describes what he did now to fulfill his mission. And it would seem, though, that the mission that he had was not to lead a revolt, but rather to make sure that the country does not get out of hand and is still controlled by the powers that be, which would be the Galilee was still either under Roman control or under the control of Agrippas, and they should not revolt. At the end of page 6 we have, but when I had dismissed my fellow legates and sent them back to Jerusalem, it's the bottom of page 6, I took care to have arms provided and the cities fortified. And when I had sent for the most hardy among the robbers, here he doesn't describe all military tactics. This is the hardy of robbers he's dealing with. I saw that it was not in my power to take their arms from them. In other words, he didn't want, evidently, again, his purpose was to pacify the area, not to provide for a credible military response to the Romans. I couldn't take my arms, but I persuaded the multitude to allow them money as pay. In other words, basically, he collected protection money and paid off the robbers so they should not harass the populace. And told them it was better for them to give them a little willingly, and as told the people, give this money now rather than be forced to overlook them when they plunder their goods from them. And then when I had obliged them to take an oath not to come into that country, as they were paid off, it's protection money, not to come in, unless they were invited to come, or unless they had not their pay given them. In other words, you see, if money doesn't come, you can come back in. I dismissed them and charged them neither to make an expedition against the Romans nor against those in their neighbors that lay around about them, for my first care was to leave Galilee in peace. This is the, so I was willing to have the principal of the Galileans and all 70 as hostages for their fidelity. We have the story of the 70 that he brought them together as part of his administration of the Galilee. Here we have a different story. He kept them as hostages, but still under the notion of friendship. In other words, so basically his intention, his real intention was to keep the peace. He was never appointed by the Sanhedrin to lead the war effort. And his story in the Roman Wars is not true, by his own admission. But he was challenged there by someone. He's called John Yochanan, the son of Levi, of Gush Cholov, Giskala, who it seems originally was not for the war. This is, as he said on page 7, when John, the son of Levi, saw some of the citizens much elevated upon the revolt from the Romans, he labored to restrain them and entreated them that they would keep their allegiance to them. In other words, he told them not to, but he could not gain his purpose, although he did his endeavors to the utmost. For the neighboring people of these were the non-Jews of Gadara, Gebara, Sogana, with the Satyrians, and of the Syrians, got together a great army and fell upon Giscala and took Giscala by force and set it upon fire. When they entire demolished it, they returned home, upon which John was so enraged that he armed all his men and joined battle with the people forementioned. Rebuilt Giscala, Gush Cholov, after a manner better than before, and fortified it with walls for its future security. You know, it's like they say, a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. It seems that he was not a member originally of these Kanoim, of the anti-Roman party, but he was a person that was for security and knew the Romans would not provide it for them. And this Yochanan became Josephus's chief adversary in the Galilee. A very telling story is, again, how it's described in his life, is that this Yochanan, this John, had a brother who was sent by John to Jerusalem, to Shimon ben Gamliel. This is the famous Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the head of the Pharisees. And he describes him, surprisingly, in wonderful terms, this Shimon ben Gamliel. He was a man of great wisdom and reason, capable of restoring public affairs by his prudence when they were in ill posture, and is a brilliant person. He was also an old friend and companion of John, which does tell you something about what kind of a person Yochanan of Gush Cholov was, if he was a personal friend of Shimon ben Gamliel. That time he had a difference with me. And Shimon ben Gamliel decided that Josephus was not the right man for the job, and Yochanan Gush Cholov should be sent to defend the Galilee. Which basically would seem that the position of Shimon ben Gamliel was that not to totally give in to the Romans, but to create a credible resistance against the Romans. Not, as it seems from the Talmud as well, with the hope of ever defeating the Romans, but perhaps by stalling them, that they would negotiate a peace whose terms would be to the liking of the Jews and not to the Herodians and not to the Sadducees, but the populace as a whole. Because the Jews didn't have, the Pharisees didn't have a problem with Roman rule. They had a problem with this terrible corruption. And that was really the thing that really created this whole revolution. And had they truly defended the country, and were able perhaps to sue for peace on favorable terms, they would have gotten rid of the control of the Herodians, and perhaps the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, would again have control over the affairs of state, in a sense, and dealing directly with the Roman governors. So you would have relative peace instead of corruption. That seems, and this is the view of Rav Isaac Halevi, the Jewish historian, seems to have been the hope of the Pharisees or Shimon ben Gamliel. That, of course, was not the aim of Josephus, who wanted to maintain the status quo. He goes on into great length, and it's worth a while, again, time doesn't allow, how through his, what seemed to be Josephus' genius, and also the fact is that he was forewarned by Josephus' father, who was close to one of the Sadducee high priests, who told him of the plan they had to get rid of Josephus and to put others in his place. Because he was forewarned, he was able to outmaneuver them and finally sent back all those that were sent by Shimon ben Gamliel, sent them back to Jerusalem. The end, of course, was that when the Romans came, there was no resistance. Josephus, in his wars, after describing what a tremendous military leader he is and how well he had trained them, is really at a loss to say that when the Romans came, there was not even a battle. All his soldiers just ran away. According to his life, really, he had no soldiers to begin with. All he had were paid mercenaries. That the people were in terror. And this is one of the reasons he was able to maintain his position in the Galilee and not be pushed out by Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. But he says, you know, if I leave or intimated, you know, all these guys won't be paid off. They're going to be coming back. There's all these mercenaries, all these thugs. And so basically you had all these hoodlums that were giving him protection money by Josephus. And when he leaves, they don't know what's going to happen to them. And through these threats, I mean, subtle threats, he was able to maintain his position, and when the Romans came, there was very little resistance, at least organized resistance. But in town after town, those who were determined not to give over again to the old status quo fought the Romans bitterly. Josephus himself, when the Romans came, escaped to Tiberias. Finally, he left Tiberias and went into the city. Yodapata, where he, when he came there, was pushed by the people to lead the resistance against the Romans, and he describes in terms, and again, it's hard to know what the truth is, but which would be fitting of any great literary work of the day. It reads like a detective novel. How he was able to time and time again to repulse the Romans. But finally, after 47 days, the Romans were able to conquer the city. Josephus was able to escape in an underground passage. We have on page 11. This is after the Romans, it says on page 11, slew all the multitude that appeared openly. They searched the hiding places and fell upon those that were underground in the caverns, went thus through every age, excepting the infants and the women, and of those that were gathered together as captives, 1,200. They got 1,200 captives, but they killed 40,000. And they demolished the cities, and the fortifications were burnt. And Josephus was hiding, and he was together with some 40 persons, and someone had divulged his whereabouts, whereupon Vespasian sent two tribunes to ask Josephus to give up, which itself is a little strange. I mean, they would afford to him, it seems they went over backwards to afford to him such... after killing this whole city, to give him the grace of, you know, to please give up. And when he refused, a third tribune, Nicanor, came to him on page 12 here. He was one that was well known to Josephus and had been his familiar acquaintance in old time. And when he was come, he enlarged upon the natural mildness of the Romans towards those that they have once conquered, you know, and told them that they should... No, they should give up. After you see, after they killed the 40,000 and burned the city, see how wonderfully mild these Romans were. Rav Isaac Halevi theorizes that actually that though Josephus really was known to them as a sympathizer, had given them inside information to the Romans, and that's why they really were on such very good terms with Vespasian, and that's why Vespasian was willing that he should give up. He wanted to give up, but the people inside did not let him. And finally he convinced the people inside, who wanted either to fight or to commit suicide and not to give up to the Romans, that they should finally, if they decide to commit suicide, which he has a lengthy speech, Josephus, to try to persuade them not to commit suicide. We're going to this next lecture about the Masada and suicide. We're going to discuss this. But he wasn't able to convince them. He convinced them, though, that they should draw lots. And it seems that luckily, or according to one version, which is not the standard version, but there's a certain version, has it that he fixed the lots, he ended up the last. As everyone else committed suicide, like the one who got the lot, well, you kill the next guy. And the one who got, you know, then he's killed by the next guy. And the one who's killed by the next. He was ended up with him and one other fellow. And he said, eh, what's the use? Might as well give up. He got up, gave himself over to Vespasian, and came over to Vespasian and told him the prophecy that he had seen in a dream that Vespasian was destined to be the emperor. The version that Josephus has, and this is all from the wars, that he was skeptical. He had others come forth to speak about other predictions that Josephus had made and were true. You have to realize Josephus was very close to the Essenes. The Essenes were known, and he describes them for their prophetic ability. It seems that he looked at himself as one of those who had these psychic talents. And the story that he tells that's recorded here, and it's an interesting thing because Vespasian, before he published this, Vespasian read through this, as well as Titus, Vespasian's son, read through this. So it would seem that there's a basis that he did make such a prediction. And he was held in chains afterwards, this Josephus, waiting to see what the outcome would be. In other words, he was a prisoner. He was had been the general, the opposing general, who had fought off the Romans for so long. He was afforded, at least perhaps by the prediction, because Nicanor had offered this to him. He was not killed immediately, but wherever the Romans went, he was kept in custody with them. And he was kept in chains. Eventually, Vespasian did become the emperor. When he saw the prophecy was true, was fulfilled, he loosened his bonds. And we have here on page 14... says that Titus had interceded on on Josephus' behalf to his father, and they cut his chains. While you receive this testimony of his integrity for reward, moreover esteemed a person of credit as to futurities also. After there was a hiatus, there was an interim period between the time where he was released and he lived in Alexandria, till the time Vespasian left, he went to take over Rome. The legions that were for Vespasian fought against who was the current Roman emperor then, Vitellius. He conquered Vespasian's legions, conquered the Vitellius's legions, and he became, through the dint of his power, the new emperor of Rome. It took time. During this time, there was no attack against the Jews in Jerusalem. But when the attack started anew, Titus, the son of Vespasian, took Josephus to be the Roman spokesman for peace toward directed at the Jews. And they used Josephus to try to speak to the populace to give up. And we have on page 14, this is in section B, in the beginning of the second paragraph. So Josephus went round about the wall and tried to find a place that was out of the reach of their darts, you know, their javelins, they had machines balustras that shot arrows. And yet within their hearing, and besought them in many words to spare themselves, to spare their country and their temple, and not to be more obdurate in these cases than foreigners themselves. But the Romans, who had no relations to those things, had reverence for their sacred rites. In other words, they would leave them alone, they should give up. Of course, they didn't listen to him, and the city was destroyed. However, when the city was destroyed, Josephus goes on to describe, and this is just a fascinating story here. We'll read together page 15. is on paragraph C, in the middle of the paragraph. Moreover, when the city Jerusalem was taken by force, Titus Caesar, no, this is Titus, persuaded me frequently to take what gave me leave so to do. In other words, I could take anything I wanted. The place was plundered. You can take what he wants. But when my country was destroyed, I thought nothing else to be of any value, which I could take and keep as a comfort under my calamities. So I made this request to Titus that my family might have their liberty. I also had the holy books by Titus's concessions. Nor was it long after that I asked of him the life of my brother and 50 friends with him, and was not denied. When I also once went to the temple by permission of Titus, where there were a great multitude of captive women and children, I got all those that I remembered as among my friends and acquaintances to be set free, being in number about 190. So I delivered them without their paying any price of redemption, restored them to their former fortune. And it was why I sent by Titus Caesar with Cerealis, 1,000 horsemen to a certain village called Tekoa, in order to know whether it were a place for a camp. Because again, he was really an ally of the Romans, and he was helping them. As I came back, I saw many captives crucified, and remember 3 of them as my former acquaintance. I was very sorry at this in my mind, and went with tears in my eyes to Titus, and told him of them. So he immediately commanded them to be taken down, have the greatest care taken of them, in order to they should recover. Yet 2 of them died under the physician's hands, while the 3rd recovered. He was not treated royally, not only in during the war and the aftermath of the war, but he continues on here on section 10 in paragraph A. When Titus had composed the troubles in Judea and conjectured that lands which I had in Judea would bring me no profit because a garrison to guard the country was after to pitch there in his old land, he gave me another country in the plain. And so he gave him land. And when he was going away to Rome, he made choice of me to sail along with him and paid me great respect. And when we were come to Rome, I had great care taken of me by Vespasian, for he gave me an apartment in his own house, which he lived in before he came to the empire. He also honored me with the privilege of a Roman citizen and gave me an annual pension and continued to respect me to the end of his life without any abatement of his kindness to me. He goes on to say that not only he, but Titus afterwards, and after Titus died, this is Domitian, this was the son of another son of Vespasian, also accorded him respect. He was, in writing this work, the original work of the wars, he was in effect Vespasian and Titus's spokesman for the Romans. Not only did they read through the work, it seems that they added to the work. Agrippus, who was the Herodian, this is the king of the Galilee, who had the influence originally over Jerusalem, also read through his writings and evidently offered him points all along. This was not just Josephus's work on his own. This was really a joint effort, it seems. And it gives you a sense of what kind of a person Josephus was and the reliability of his history. So let's just recap and say, what do we have of the life of Josephus so far? He comes from a prestigious priestly family. He seems to be a brilliant person. His leanings emotionally is with the status quo, with Rome, with Agrippas, with the Herodians, with the Sadducees, in terms of the lifestyle. It seems this is where the social setting of the friends of his parents. He himself, though, was somewhat troubled by the Sadducees, by all of this, went through a whole period of groping, finally ended up to live a life of the Pharisees, which you'll see was not truly a Pharisee. It was not a yeshiva bacher here. Here is a person who was who felt quite at ease in Roman culture, dealing with Romans, this Nicanor, this tribune, there's a military tribune, you don't understand, in a Roman legion, there are six tribunes. These are these minor officers under the legate, in other words, the leader of the legion. This is a high officer, and he was his personal friend. To give you a sense of what kind of a person Josephus was. He came there to not to lead the revolt, but really is to lead the peace. And that's why Shimon ben Gamliel wanted to get rid of him. But he was unsuccessful. They were not able to mount a credible resistance. There were cities. They never fought against the Romans in conjunction one with as in pitched battles, nor did they really, in terms of guerrilla warfare, did not attack the Romans. They just went into their individual towns that were fortified. So one town after the next did the Romans come, conquer and burn down, kill the inhabitants. So hundreds of thousands of people were killed. This Josephus became then the spokesman for the Romans, was a close friend of the Roman emperors, and it gives you a sense of what kind of a person Josephus was. What was Josephus's true attitude towards the Pharisees? And here we're going to quote just a few instances of how he describes the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the rabbinic establishment. The rabbis of the Talmud, the rabbis of today, trace their descent to the Pharisees. And here he describes in paragraph A, when the Maccabee king, Hyrcanus, he was the son of Shimon, the last surviving brother of the Maccabees, who originally this Hyrcanus was a Pharisee, and later on became a Sadducee, and describes his change. And he starts off this prosperous state of affairs on page 17, paragraph A, moved the Jews to envy Hyrcanus. But they that were the worst disposed to him were the Pharisees, who were one of the sects of the Jews, as we have informed you already. These have so great a power over the multitude that when they say anything against the king or against the high priest, they are presently believed. Those are very dangerous people. And the Pharisees were worse disposed because they were so envious of him, it seems. This sounds to be the writings of a Sadducee, not of a Pharisee. Describing Hyrcanus had a son, Yanai, who upon Yanai's death gave advice to his wife that she should go together with the Pharisees to ensure the peace of the kingdom. For he told her that they had great authority among the Jews both to do hurt to such as they hated and to bring advantage to those to whom they were friendly disposed. For they that they were then believed best by all the multitude when they speak any severe thing against others. They have tremendous power. Now, you have to realize these were the Rabbonim. Josephus did a tremendous disservice to Jewish history when he labeled the Pharisees a sect. Well, I don't know how the Balabatim here look at their Rabbonim, but generally you don't look at the spiritual leadership of a community as a separate sect. Then you have to look at the community as a whole as a sect. And he described them as a sect. Though it be only out of envy at them that they describe this hatred. Right. Again, this is not the writings of a Pharisee himself. So it gives you a sense of what his feelings were for the Pharisee. He equally had problems, though, with the Sadducees, even though perhaps he, in a certain sense, his parents came from that milieu. But this evidently brought as why he was so troubled, that he tried to go from one extreme to the other. However, moreover, the Pharisees is on page 18, are friendly to one another and for the exercise of concord in regard to the public, in paragraph A. But the behavior of the Sadducees one toward another is in some degree wild. Their conversation with those that are of their own party is as barbarous as they were strangers to them. He has problems with the Sadducees. But he has mixed emotions. In Antiquities, he describes the story of Ananus. This is Ananus ben Ananus, or Hanan, this is Honan ben Honan. This young Ananus was a bold man in his temper and very insolent. He was also the sect of the Sadducees, who were very rigid in judging offenders, above all the rest of the Jews, as we've already observed. He goes on, we have a sense of the... he describes another Sadducee high priest. This is Jesus, in other words, this is Yeshua, this is the Greek form of Yeshua. The son of Gamaliel became the successor of Jesus, the son of Damnius, in the high priesthood, which a king had taken from the other. Again, this is the king, in other words, Agrippus, who was really the king of Galilee, but had control over Jerusalem, took one from the other. On which account a sedition arose between the high priests with regards to one another. For they got together bodies of the boldest sort of the people and frequently came from reproaches to throwing of stones at each other. But Ananias was too hard for the rest by his riches, which enabled him to gain those that were most ready to receive. In others, he bribed the thing. And it came from time... From that time it principally came to pass that our city was greatly disordered and all things grew worse and worse among us. So here in Antiquities, again, he wrote this in the year 93 of the Common Era. He was born, Joseph was in the year 37. So he was in his mid-50s when he wrote this. He's very critical of them. Yet right after the war, and again, I don't have time doesn't allow, but it's worthwhile for you just to look yourself. Here on paragraph D on page 18, he describes the most glowing terms about this Ananus, which he described as insolent, as a Sadducee, as a lover of peace, and describes also this Jesus, the son of Gamaliel, also as this on the top of 19, describing this, Jesus was also joined with him, although he was inferior to him upon comparison, he was superior to the rest. He evidently had very much mixed feelings about these people. He liked them because they were pro-Roman. They were cosmopolitan. They shared many of the Goyishkeit, many of the establishment mores that he was comfortable with. On the other hand, he still had schooling from other parts, and he was able to criticize them. So he was. It comes the work of a very complicated person. Unfortunately, his words are taken at face value by historians, who often look at him. Well, he was a Pharisee, and take that this is really what we call mainstream sentiments. Again, as the time doesn't allow, we've discussed this last week, Josephus and the Essenes, here on page 19, again, he describes in the most glowing terms. And evidently his true love was for these Essenes. The Essenes were against the Pharisees. They were not very cosmopolitan, but they were very spiritual. And they had the sense of the divine. I would just like to leave now just with two points, just briefly, and then we will leave this open to any questions. First one is, what kind of a scholar was Josephus? He said he had studied,
He had been 14 years old. Zim Netem Getzatzkit, in other words, they came to ask his advice. What kind of a scholar was he? He interprets here on page 19, section 14. He says, our legislator has expressly forbidden us to deride or blaspheme the gods recognized by others out of respect of the very word God. In other words, the prohibition of cursing Elohim, he describes as Elohim gods. This is a view which is maintained by Philo as well. This is not mainstream Jewish thought, the prohibition of blaspheming pagan gods. He has a thing that there are 7 men to judge in every city. The Talmudic, the tradition which is recorded in the Mishnah is that the major courts had 23 members in the cities. Let every judge have 2 officers. A lot of them out of the tribe of Levi is unknown in the Talmud. What's interesting, though, is for him that act contrary to this law, let him be beaten 40 stripes save one, which is not the plain meaning of Scripture, but is the law of the Mishnah, which is... This is part of the tradition, though, that he had studied. What's interesting, you could look at the others just on paragraph F here on page 20. He that maimeth anyone, let him undergo the like himself and be deprived the same member which he deprived the other. In other words, an eye for an eye. Unless he that is maimed will accept of money instead of it. Rabbinic tradition is that the idea of an eye for an eye, it means mamon, means really financial restitution. It does not mean taking an eye for an eye. Josephus has really both. It has the literal translation, that's an eye for an eye, but allows for the taking money in its stead. Again, this is not part of rabbinic tradition. I just quote a few things. There are others. There's only just a smattering of the kind of things you get by studying Josephus. But there is one, we said that there was one major legacy that he left us, a very positive one. One of his major works, or the last one of his life, is written as Against Apion. It was a defense against anti-Semitism. This is really a subject we'll devote an entire lecture to some weeks, a few weeks. He describes in glowing terms what Judaism is. I would like to hear, I have one paragraph here, which is printed on page 20. I would like just to quote from the last paragraph of Against Apion, and then we'll open the floor for questions. As to the laws themselves, he's speaking about the Torah, more words are unnecessary, for they are visible in their own nature and appear to teach not impiety, but the truest piety in the world. They do not make men hate one another, but encourage people to communicate what they have to one another freely. They are enemies of it to injustice, and they take care of righteousness. They banish idleness and expensive living, and instruct men to be content with what they have, to be laborious in their callings. They forbid men to make war from a desire of getting more, make men courageous in defending the laws. This is just a sampling of the type of things that he writes about the Torah. This was written to non-Jews. Again, this is something which we will discuss at length in a different lecture. But Menashe ben Yisroel was a chief rabbi of Amsterdam in Holland in the 17th century. Had this Against Apion reprinted in Hebrew. It was maintained in Latin. So Jews should read what this is. It's a beautiful work. Again, we will touch about some of these things in subsequent lectures. And what Josephus left us is really a very mixed legacy. On one hand, he left us a very negative legacy of attitudes towards the Pharisees, which comes through and through his works. very positive attitude towards the Herodians, to the Romans. But on the other hand, there was much part of him that was very much loyal to his original faith. I mean, it was the faith he kept. And in that, in his preface of this work against Apion, he did a great service, to Jewry. And for us, for ourselves, love is a legacy, to understand what the problems of anti-Semitism were in antiquity, which were much the same as they are today, and to give us an appreciation of the Torah itself. Next, in 2 weeks from now, we will be going through the story of Masada, the revolt, and the issue of the mass suicide that the people, the defenders of Masada went through, and the issue of suicide in general. Okay, now, are there any questions?
This one.
Against it, this was towards the end. He was in his mid-60s. Yes. Yeah. The question was asked about the story of Vespasian, that the prediction that Josephus predicted he would be king has a parallel in the Talmud, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai snuck out of Jerusalem and met Vespasian. He also made the prediction. It's the same king. The basis of Yochanan ben Zakkai's prediction was based on the logical assertion that Jerusalem would only fall through a great man. As to the dignity of the Jews, it wouldn't fall to just an underling, but it would fall to somebody of prestige. It would fall to the king. Okay, there are two questions. One is about the value of Josephus. Here we find that he contradicts himself. Like, what kind of historian is he? And the next question was, does he write about Christianity? In terms of his first question, Josephus, by and large, when he wrote his work of antiquities, was relying on other works that were current at the time. So basically, we are reading other people's histories. When he was writing about the various Roman affairs and antiquities, again, he was using Roman sources.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture.